Pleased to be here with you this afternoon. My name is Kevin Barnett. I'm with the Public Health Institute based in Oakland, California. I'm here and appreciate the opportunity to work with Peggy and her colleagues because I've spent most of the last 20 years after training in public health and city and regional planning, doing research, providing tools, encouraging, cajoling, and when all else fails, coercing hospitals to be more strategic about how they invest in addressing not simply the symptoms, but the underlying causes of health problems in local communities. And in doing this work, I've often felt like a voice in the wilderness, in that many of my colleagues in the public health community accused me of going to the dark side by working with hospitals. But I'm happy to say that both in the public health community and in the hospital community, there is a dramatic increased interest and commitment to look at ways of working together, to a large degree because of the run-up to health reform and the understanding that regardless of what happens in the coming months, everybody understands that the current system of financing based on fee-for-service, which encourages hospitals to fill beds and conduct procedures, is coming to an end. And what that means by extension is hospitals are going to have to build population health capacity because they're going to have to learn how to keep populations healthy through some form of global budgeting that is ultimately down the road. So it's an exciting time to be doing this work and to be exploring ways of bringing the hospital and public health community together. What I'm going to do briefly is to give you an overview of where we've gone with community benefit, its origins, evolution of policies and practices, talk about some of the issues around scrutiny and where we are now as it relates to both the recent revisions in the IRS 990 Schedule H and the community benefit elements of health reform. Then I'll touch on what are some of the opportunities for alignment priorities and the aims that Peggy has outlined, and along with each one of those, I'll share one or two exemplary practices. So, what is community benefit? Here's an excerpt of the definition, really the core, as it was defined by the IRS in ruling 69545 back in 69. You'll see the language, in essence, is population health language. It infers both defining what your community is and defining the cohort that you're going to serve such that you're able to yield some kind of measurable improvement. So I think it's always important when we're going to talk about this concept. Yes, it is how hospitals fulfill their charitable obligations, but it's important to understand what's at the core of the definition of community benefit. Now, why did the IRS change the definition? Changed the definition because this was shortly after Medicare and Medicaid legislation had been passed, and we had what I guess Alan Greenspan would have called irrational exuberance in the thought that we had created universal access for everybody, that we had everybody covered. Obviously, that didn't turn out to be the case, but it raised the question at the time, how are not nonprofit hospitals going to fulfill their charitable obligations, if not through the provision of charity care. So we broadened it to encourage hospitals to get out and be more proactive in their community. There's a lot of good work out there, I will tell you, and I've had the pleasure of working with some terrific people. But in a lot of hospitals, there is this tendency to just want to tally up everything we can possibly get in there and count that as community benefit. And that's part of the challenge that we're looking to address as we improve practices. Just a quick example, I always like to have one extreme example out there. Now, I don't have anything against sea otters, but this is an example from a newspaper article in Oregon of a hospital that provided the use of its MRI for a sea otter at the local local zoo. And the CEO was quite proud of the fact that they had provided this, and this was a part of his community benefit plan. Well, this is exactly the kinds of activities that often get reported as an example of why hospitals are not really committed to community benefit. But that's on the negative side. Nevertheless, there is immense room for improvement, and many hospitals, I would say, are actively engaged in looking at ways of strengthening their activities rather than casting bread on the water, looking at ways in which it can build synergies across programs to have fewer but larger, more comprehensive approaches to health improvement, make sure that we have an infrastructure or we partner with local public health agencies, schools of public health, and others that have the external expertise to actually monitor whether or not these programs are achieving impact. And last but certainly not least, looking at ways of mobilizing, leveraging our resources through engagement of broad-based community stakeholders. Then on the institutional side, making sure that we have the infrastructure insight for governance and oversight, which primarily involves bringing outside people in to help and bring their expertise to help look at these programs, and to look at ways in which through this effort, through bringing in additional competencies, we can do a better job of this work. One of the ways that I frame this for folks at hospitals, that in many ways, this is not about spending more money, but it's about spending the money you spend more effectively. I promise I will not go through all of these, but this is a quick one-slide overview of where we've gone in terms of policy, going all the way back to the IRS redefinition. A lot of the early actions were class actions by cities against hospitals that had originally served people in the immediate neighborhoods. As we began to look at white flight and outward movement of the suburban, of the middle class into suburbia and lower SES groups into these neighborhoods, you saw patterns of these hospitals jumping over these neighborhoods and serving the more affluent suburbs, and cities appropriately questioned whether or not they were fulfilling their charitable obligations and actually justifying their exemption for municipal property taxes. We began to move into state statutes first in 1990 with in New York and in Utah, and the growth of a number of other approaches. We, in essence, have two kinds of statutes for community benefits around the state. Three states, Texas, Utah, and Pennsylvania, have minimum financial threshold statutes. In essence, you have to do a certain amount in order to justify your tax exemption, usually the value of your tax exemption. And the rest are reporting laws. In essence, you're supposed to review your mission, conduct a community health assessment, and develop and submit a plan to the states. The one thing most of these laws have in common is that there's a rush to pass the law, but not funds allocated to provide oversight. And as a result, most people submit the plans, they go into a filing cabinet somewhere, and nobody looks at it. That, folks, is about to change. But really, an early part of that change was in 2005, Yale New Haven Hospital in Connecticut had received a $20 million endowment that was specifically supposed to go for financing charity care. It used those funds, or it basically sat on those funds. At the same time, it went after people who would have clearly qualified for charity care and applied a number of punitive measures. This hit the Wall Street Journal and a number of the major publications in it, and it opened up a level of scrutiny that has really continued ever since. With Senate Finance Committee and other both committees in the Senate and in the House began to challenge these issues. So one of the things that happened is the IRS staff got tired of being called before committees and being asked by legislators, so what are you doing to make sure hospitals are doing the right thing, and not being able to do anything but scratch their heads. So they have developed the IRS 990 Schedule H. I'll touch on a few elements here in a moment, but that substantially increases the scrutiny and the focus, and in many senses, the level of data that is out there is going to be a bonanza for public health doctoral students that want to do comparative analyses. So there's a lot of rich data available that will be available for use in the very near future. So for hospitals, assuming we do proceed and assume we bring folks on board in 2014, have a window here where we're still going to have a large number of uninsured. And what we're saying in the area of community benefit is here's an opportunity with this cohort of folks for whom you're getting little or no money to look at ways in which you can build population health capacity. Because most of the rest of your populations are fee-for-service. It works against you to try to keep them healthy. So let's look at how we can keep healthy the populations that are the most challenged, the populations that you should be serving and fulfilling your community benefit obligations with. So in that vein, I launched a multi-state demonstration project in 2002 that was called Advancing the State of the Art in Community Benefit. And we engaged about 70 hospitals in California, Texas, Arizona, and Nevada, and developed for the first 2 years a set of uniform standards on the programmatic and institutional side, and in the next 2 years field tested and refined those. Those standards, I'm happy to say, have been adopted not only by the hospitals and health systems that participated in the initial demonstration, but increasingly by hospitals and health systems around the country. And I currently have a grant from the Kellogg Foundation, and it's where a number of these examples come from, where we're documenting programs and policies that these nine health systems that we currently have engaged that are doing that reflect dramatic movement in the direction that we're talking about. So in essence, what we're saying that the traditional ad hoc approach to community benefit represents poor stewardship. And the way that nonprofit hospitals can and should be distinguishing themselves in the future as is with a commitment and a movement from input, simply tallying up the dollars, to outcomes and quality, and then focusing on the issue of prevention. We have five core principles that drive this work programmatically. First is an emphasis on communities with disproportionate unmet needs, that is really making sure if we want to achieve measurable improvements, we're focusing in those communities that are most impacted. An emphasis on primary prevention, a focus on building community capacity. In basic terms, before we do anything, let's find out what's already going on, and let's think strategically how we can build on what's already going on. Building the seamless continuum of care is, in essence, the evidence-based practices that Peggy was talking about. How we link what we're doing in an upstream way in communities to what happens in the clinical setting. And how do we help streamline and increase the effectiveness of our efforts. And last but not least, a commitment to engage the full spectrum of diverse community stakeholders as equal partners in the process. So we have a set of actions that we look at from hospitals that are tied to the three major goals of reducing disparities, reducing healthcare costs, and increasing community problem solving. And then on the institutional side, another set of measures that lead towards the three major goals of increased accountability, and within that, transparency, objectivity in decision making, and a focus on diversity, quality, and sustainability. So there are a number of tools and model policies and practices that you can go to that are on the website for this at asacb.org that describe all of this in greater detail. So what we're seeing with all these hospitals is a lot more direct accountability for community benefit performance among the senior leadership, the establishment of a board-level committee that typically is a majority of external community stakeholders, with folks with epidemiological expertise, folks that understand intersectoral collaboration, and folks that have had long-term residence in communities with disproportionate unmet needs. Dramatic increase in coordination across clinical departments with a major focus on reducing preventable hospitalization and ED utilization, and coordination between what we do in community benefit and the finance departments. So again, this the focus here with the passage of health reform is how to really be much more strategic and how to advance this notion of prevention as the identity of hospitals, particularly nonprofits. So many of you have seen the research that was begun by John Billings initially, and many others have taken up on reducing ambulatory care sensitive conditions. Many of you have seen the study that ARC did that came out a couple years ago documenting the hospital spent approximately $30 billion a year for preventable hospitalization. This is just a limited set of ICD-9 codes that they look at, and it represents 10% of total hospital expenditures. Obviously, seat CMS, under the leadership of Don Berwick, is already putting in place reductions in payment for readmissions, a substantial amount of those that were deemed avoidable. So there's a fair amount of money in the system that we're wasting. It's fairly low-hanging fruit that if we work together more effectively, we can help move this agenda. So our canary in the coal mine is Massachusetts. It's passed their legislation. They're seeing their charity roles, care roles drop, and they have a commission that starts with a preamble that we have to move beyond fee-for-service care. Borrowed this slide from colleague and friend Ed O'Neill at UCSF Center for Health Professions, in part because it really characterizes in broad ways in which what a hospital is today is going to change. And you look at the right and you look at a lot of the issues that we used to define more with what public health is about. So we're seeing a lot more potential for alignment than we ever have in the past. This slide is intended to capture the fact that currently under the three areas described up there, clinical service delivery in the red, community-based preventive services in the green, primary prevention in the yellow, if as long as you focus on uninsured and underinsured populations now, anything you do in all three of those areas is a community benefit. But as we move in terms of payment models, incentives, and metrics from the current system, which basically incentivizes conducting procedures and filling beds, towards more episodic-based reimbursement, partial full-risk capitation, to global budgeting, with all the associated changes in incentives and metrics, at some point that dotted line is intended to capture that most of the things in these two, in the red and the green that we currently define as community benefits, are going to be captured in some form of reimbursement. What does that mean? That means that most of the $12 to $15 billion that hospitals currently report as community benefits is going to have to go into primary prevention. So immense potential for greater partnership and coordination between public health and hospitals. So the new 501R element of the health reform legislation, some specific language from it, it requires each hospital to conduct a community health needs assessment, calls on bringing into the input from folks, including those with special knowledge and expertise in public health, and that the hospital has to adopt an implementation strategy to meet identified needs. Some clarifications offered more recently from the Joint Committee was an understanding that we've got people doing assessments all over the place. And what we really need to do is to use the available data that we have out there and actually free some of the data up, some of the resources up to do more drilling down, which is what we need to do. But the other clarification was to say that, in fact, you have to have done a needs assessment at some point in the run-up to 2013, not by 2013, or not in 2013. So other element here in the Schedule H, the organization needs to assess how the organization is going to assess those needs and disclose both how they're addressing the needs that are identified and a description of any needs that are not being addressed with the reason why those needs are not being addressed. I think this is somewhat problematic. In part, some of the things that we're hearing from folks is saying, well, gosh, maybe we need to scale back the scope of needs that were identified so we don't get held responsible for addressing every need. And it runs against our efforts to try to be more strategic and to bring more focused resources in areas to achieve measurable improvements. So these are the basic categories, and we'll spend a lot of time on those in the interest of time. But again, to summarize some of the challenges that we have. One of the issues is that the current Schedule H is silent on the issue of priority setting. So we really don't know how we get from typical needs assessment. You may identify 100 or more unmet needs. So how do we, and what criteria do we use to narrow down from those 100 unmet needs and a whole range of unintended consequences? The real positive is that a dramatic increase in specificity, greater transparency, and opportunity for comparative analysis. The most problematic, particularly from a public health perspective, is that the staff at the IRS, which are primarily attorneys, have decided that this area of community building, shouldn't be countable as a community benefit. So we're talking about youth leadership development, social support systems, physical infrastructure improvement, in essence, the most upstream kinds of public health activities. They're saying you can't count us as a community benefit. Most of the public health community is currently unaware of this, and there's a dramatic need for the public health community to stand up and say, this isn't right. This is exactly where we want hospitals to begin to focus their investments. So I say this with a plea. Talk to your colleagues. Look at ways in which we can increase attention to this issue. So obviously there's some challenges that we have, some historical dynamics between public health and hospitals, some negative views of each other on both sides, but some immense possibilities of taking advantage of synergistic linkages. Certainly one of those areas are areas for joint advocacy, policy advocacy on issues. Others is looking at ways in which we can secure increased support from conversion foundations together to do this kind of work. I'll say a few words on an initiative in California that some of you may have heard of that really we're really operationalizing this work that I'm describing. The California Endowment, our biggest foundation in California, is making a 10-year investment in 14 communities, $1 to $3 million a year in each of these communities. These are usually two or three zip codes within a city or within a rural area that happen to be the most impacted of communities, but they're having a primary central focus on social determinants. So what I'm doing with them on this initiative is doing an analysis of what all the hospitals say they're doing, all the hospitals that are proximal to those communities, what they say they're doing in those communities. What I've found in reviewing the reporting is a lot of problems with the reporting, but we're also finding examples where there's a disconnect between the programs and the communities with disproportionate unmet health needs. Nobody really knows where people in these communities are getting their services, so the need to accelerate our work in electronic health records, but also to create systems where we can map and look at these together is critically important. But there's immense opportunity we're finding for win-wins in this process. So what we're talking about and what I'm talking to you about is a shift in the model of community benefit. Historically, it's been a competitive model, and you have hospitals that say, we don't want to work with these other hospitals in our own community around this problem. So you get fragmentation, you get limited impact, you lose credibility often because you're not having an impact. We're not really in a position to move this forward. And in the long term, again, as we begin to shift financing mechanisms, it's a threat to your long-term economic viability because you're not going to be able to do this work effectively. So the geographic model really looks at how we can achieve some kind of multiplier impact, how we build this internal capacity, and how in partnership with the public health community, we look at policy development opportunities. As an example, a couple of the maps that we've developed these maps in each one of these communities. This is East Oakland building healthy communities. You'll see the blackened area are the areas where they're focusing their services. And each of the dots on there of different colors are programs of different focus. So you have what you have in the on the brown down there are environmental related, are safe travel, safe school activities in the East Oakland area. But what you see is most of the other activities around healthy eating, healthy living, sort of youth development, and health services are all concentrated in the downtown area, where the hospitals are, not where the community is most impacted. So this provides a very effective starting point for discussion with hospitals on how some of these programs can be retrofitted, relocated, and replicated in a way that they build on what the endowment is already investing in these communities. So another example in the city of Richmond, in their particular area, here you see more of a concentration of programs where they're needed the greatest. But part of the challenge that we have there is how to link and how to build on some of these broad-based programs. So, summarize, what are some of the opportunities for alignment between the quality aims and community benefit? So, We're talking about moving from the institutional to a geographic approach to community benefit, clearly moving to the population-centered approach, increasing our expectations with a clear focus where the need is the greatest to address disparities. It just so happens, and this is not only in California, our communities with disproportionate unmet needs also tend to be our most ethnically and culturally diverse communities, the communities that are experiencing the disparities. So by getting the focus in these areas, we have the greatest opportunity to look at ways in which we can, in a measurable way, reduce health disparities. Some of the challenges are, and this is particularly given the most recent downturn, a lot of local public health agencies have been losing resources, and they have less capacity, and over the last few decades have been more and more constrained by categorical funding. So it's harder and harder for them to do the kind of exactly the kind of population health work we're trying to get hospitals to do. Working against that, an example, this demonstration project we have under development, we've submitted a request to ARC for, but they're already moving forward in varying ways. All the hospitals and the public health department are at the table in San Francisco. And what we're looking to do there is to establish a regional data house, a clearinghouse with a full-time epidemiologist based in the public health department who will have access to all the utilization data sets for all the hospitals. These will be mapped, geocoded, and then linked to the social determinant data that the public health department has been collecting and mapping. And these data will be used as an evidence base for targeted investment in neighborhoods like Bayview, Hunters Point, Western Addition, and others where it's needed the most. Similar project underway in the Dallas area. In their case, it's the Dallas Hospital Council, but the Public Health Department, as well as the Public Hospital Parkland Memorial, are all at the table in this process as well. But both of these involve really moving towards this more geographic mapping strategy, evidence-based strategy, to move this agenda. And a big part of it, clearly, is how through this process they position themselves to advocate for local regional policy changes, if not state policy changes, to support and sustain these efforts. So on the evidence-based practices side, expanding partnerships to really strengthen evaluation, leverage hospital investments, identify service gaps, and really get folks to collaborate across disciplines and sectors. So an example, and we've got a lot of examples here where the health system in Oregon that's part of this has an ongoing partnership and co-investment with the Deschutes County Public Health Department, where they co-locate services, where they've gotten public transportation services changed, secured additional funding, and provide a lot of support to keep these going. Public health workforce and education. In my other area of work is around health professions, workforce diversity, and workforce development. And I'll tell you, there's immense work and development in this arena. Lots of examples where we're getting a lot more target investment by health professions employers in pipeline expansion, engagement of community health clinics, to look at ways in which to build two-way avenues to increase cultural competency within the hospitals, as well as provide support where clinics are experiencing shortages of workers. But what we see are a lot of competitive dynamics between the public sector, public health clinics, and FQHCs, and the sort of the disconnect that we see between healthcare and public health, the historical disconnect, means that most of this pipeline work is focused on healthcare, not public health. So a lot of our work now is how to make sure that we are exposing kids to the broad spectrum of public health career opportunities that are out there as well. A great example here in Aurora Health Clinic in Milwaukee area, where they've not only invested heavily in establishing this free clinic, but they're working with local medical schools to build rotations, develop collaborative to do sharing for purchase of pharmaceuticals, and just ongoing increasing partnership with both the public health department there and the local medical school. On the area of systems thinking, this notion of building a common platform for policy advocacy. I mentioned earlier is this issue of community building. This is probably a great starting point because it's at a high enough level that it's something that we can all agree upon, but we have to get down to the point where we're challenging our local policymakers to look at ways of invest in these kinds of areas. Our challenge is at the federal level is there's a very reductionist thinking in most of our agencies and looking at how they fund research and programs. A lot of what we're talking about is changing paradigms. But most of our agencies just want to fund, you're going to test this intervention against that intervention. That's research that needs to be funded, but we also need to fund the real paradigm change work that needs to happen at the local level. And it just doesn't happen if the agencies are not thinking about how they coordinate and how they fund and incentivize this kind of development. A couple quick examples of ways in which hospitals are really invested. The Bell Hill Initiative by UMass Memorial Health System in Worcester, Mass., a very broad-based investment in this neighborhood that includes housing development, includes environmental improvement. And these folks basically said, well, it's fine. The IRS not going to let us count this stuff, but we still need to do this. But we need to make sure that we address that. Baylor Healthcare System in Dallas have built investing a lot of dollars in renovating and expanding a historical youth development center. They're going to have some diabetes treatment. I'll tell you, the prevalence of diabetes in this neighborhood is really depressing. We drove around the neighborhood. I don't think we crossed a single block where we didn't see somebody in a wheelchair who had a limb amputated. It's a major problem in this area, and it also happens to be, of course, a food desert. So how is it we're going to address these issues? They recognize, they say, you know, Joe Allison, the CEO, said this is a tsunami. If we don't really step up and look at ways of addressing these underlying causes, there's no way we're going to possibly address it. So those are some of the examples. I could go on, and my friends know I can go on, but I want to leave some time for questions and discussion and input. Thank you.
Thanks. So I don't know if there's a way to get the lights turned up a little bit, because I don't know if there's something in the back there for you, if one of you guys could take a look, because it's hard to see everybody. So I don't know if you're all sleeping or... Oh, okay, great. Thanks. So two really interesting presentations, and as Kevin was talking, I recently actually left Yale University and was thinking about, but I was not working at Yale New Haven Hospital, and I do know about what happened, because we were having trouble getting patients into the clinics from the emergency department and having them pay fees that were scaled. And what was actually happening was the hospital was putting liens on people's houses. They were sending collection agencies out after these people who really didn't have the funds to pay for their primary care visits or their hospital visits, and it got to be a real nightmare. So but we also have a collaborative project that's been going on between the School of Public Health, School of Medicine, and School of Nursing, and one of the FQHCs running a free clinic. But the public health students are also involved, and they're doing the management sort of the clinic, and the med students and nursing students are doing some of the clinical care. So it's a really neat model, and they've been running it now for about 4 or 5 years. And they have a one attending physician there all the time to just kind of oversee things, and it's been a successful clinic. And they're seeing a lot of undocumented immigrants, which we have a large number of in New Haven. So anyway, so that's enough about that. So I'm sure you all have some comments, some questions, and so let's, you know, if you have anything. And when you do talk, could you introduce yourself and say where you're from, so it helps everybody to get to know one another. Great.
So, about 6 months, a year ago, and he told me about the IRS prohibition of community building, counting that for a and I've been working with health departments now at one hospital, it's not something that I'm really focused on, but I thought about it. Two thoughts. One was, if the community building, I think is part of, on paper, perhaps on a strategy map, on a logic model, or a clear plan to reduce chronic disease, or whatever the, you know, reduce preventable chronic disease, whatever the community, clear community health goal is, shouldn't that make it count?
That's a great question, and the good news is that many hospitals and health systems are finding ways of framing this so they can still count some of those activities. The bad news is that many are saying, well, gosh, if we can't count this, then it's too much trouble. Because part of the problem that we're dealing with, part of the challenge is how to build capacity, how to build that population health capacity in hospitals. And there has been a dramatic increase in hiring people with public health expertise to run community benefit programming in the hospital. But historically, it's been viewed as a reporting responsibility. So they usually are often getting young people out of schools in communication or good writers and who would write these reports. Now there's a growing recognition that this is actually, it's not and shouldn't just be a marginal enterprise. Not only should we be hiring people with public health expertise to manage these, but we need somebody with a public health degree in our senior leadership team to make sure that we're thinking about these issues. But it's a gradual process. You have to have somebody, typically at that upper level, that says, hey, let's not walk away from this. Let's figure out a way that we can do a workaround for the time being. If you don't have that, you have somebody down at the lower level who just told, yeah, let's get rid of this.
And another thought was, well, we can't do it, but we know it needs to be done, and there are other people in the community who are good at it, so we'll partner with you to do that part of it, and we'll do another piece.
Right. And a lot of the creativity is going on, but we're also losing a lot. I described this, and I had a very public discussion with the head of IRS staff around this issue, and I said, we're sort of strangling the baby in the bathwater here, because this, we've just started to get folks to do this work, and you're telling them it's not a bad.
Yeah, please.
This is Mary Kate. I work at the National Association of County and City Health Officials in D.C., and as I was listening to you from the local public health perspective, I was wanting to know what strategies there are, what are the best practices for a local public health practitioner to approach their hospital, and also with the exemplary hospitals that you listed or the communities that you listed, were there any that really had poor community relationships 5 or 10 years ago and now they're on your slideshow, and what that evolution looked like? Or were they all just really great at engaging their community always, and so their shift wasn't really a shift, it's just they're good.
I wish I could give you a more clear-cut answer, but there definitely has been an upward movement in commitment and understanding of responsibilities around these issues and creativity. Whether or not there are any in these particular communities that you're talking about, there's a hospital, but typically has to be somebody at the top that has a vision and recognizes. And I got to say, if you don't recognize that you need to move in this direction, in my view, you should be at the leadership of the hospital. But there are still a lot of those leaders out there. But typically start with, if there is somebody who is at the manager or director level in charge of community benefit, if not, it would typically be somebody who is at the VP level for mission or public affairs or government affairs who has this responsibility, and explore where they're at on this and if they're interested in partnering. They should have already contacted, if they're at all awake, they should have already contacted the public health department about working together on the assessment requirement that they have before them. But you may also find that they may be working with the United Way on the assessment. As you know, United Way does this work as well. But our challenge is how to get folks together. And I should say something I didn't know is in many communities around the country, they are actually collaborating and doing the assessments together. The problem is at the end of the assessment process, everybody takes their toys and goes home and does their own programs. So our challenge now is to take and say, how do we do this work together? How do we put our resources together with the communities to have to do that?
Okay. Behind my, yeah.
There. I'm Nicole Grant from North Carolina. I just wanted to share the model that we have there that works. The hospital in the county, their community benefits program is actually a grants program. So they send out an RFP once a year to community-based organizations, public health organizations, FQHCs, and the like. And they, you know, those community organizations then write a proposal, and they have, you know, priority areas, access to care, things like activity, nutrition, substance abuse, things of those, you know, things of that nature. Those priority areas are chosen by the community health needs assessment. So then, you know, the work is being done by these community-based organizations with the funding and support of the hospital. So the hospital sort of the wind beneath their wings and kind of helps them do that without the hospital having to be actively involved other than getting grant funding. And they'll grant a program for up to 3 years, and that tends to help foster some nice relationships. The lady was asking, you know, how there was a relationship before, how did you know for that? Mm-hmm. And people tend to get along better when there's money flowing.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned North Carolina. I did a workshop there in March about the State Public Health Department and hospital leadership. And there's a lot of collaboration there. I was quite surprised. It's probably among the best in the country. Folks are really thinking about how they can work together. So come in and learn your work.
Great. Before Mike, I'll have you next. I forgot to mention that in the most recent edition of The Nation's Health, there's also an interview with Dr. Koh about quality, and we have some copies of that if anybody doesn't have a copy and is interested. So you can just see Corinne if you need one. Mike, go ahead.
Well, it's a good transition, but I want to come back to that.
Yep, go ahead.
I'm from Colorado.
Any other comments, or do you guys have any final words, comments?
Well, I guess my primary thing is that I really do look forward to moving toward some kind of collaboration with the accident hospitals on adapting some of these concepts. I think it's very important for the public health community to embrace this within the spirit of health reform. I think this is the direction that we really need to move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would just note one other class of hospitals I didn't really address, and that is our public hospitals.
Mm.
And many of those that are still public facilities but are now operated by nonprofits. These are my Highland Hospital in Oakland. I just returned from the site visit of Hennepin County Medical Center up in Minneapolis. A number of hospitals are basically moving, have become nonprofits in part to separate themselves one step from the county supervisors and to have a board that operates that kind of
I mention them because much of what the way the public hospitals approach serving the medically indigent is through the emergency, is in a very reactive way. They also, almost all of their resources are public resources, so we ought to be asking how we spend those public resources as well. So many of these newly established nonprofits that were once public hospitals are now thinking fundamentally at how they become more proactive. So we ought to make sure that we're thinking about how we engage these kinds of institutions as well in looking at those institutions being more proactive.
Okay, great. Well, I want to thank you all for being here and thank both Peggy and Kevin for the presentations. And if you need a copy of The Nation's Health, there's more in the exhibit hall. the booth number, yeah. So if you do want to...
1377.
Okay, 1377. Okay, great. So thanks a lot, and thank you.